You're listening to an episode of a Wondery Plus exclusive series. To continue listening, join Wondery Plus and enjoy ad-free listening to over 40,000 episodes, early access to your favorite podcasts, and more. Find Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's September 1940. The Battle of Britain is raging. Royal Air Force pilot Johnson is flying through the air over England, looking for a German bomber. Germany has been relentlessly bombing England for months, showing the world its impressive aerial power. Johnson is exhausted.
"Come on, come on. Where are you, you Nazi chump?"
Moments ago, England's air detection system, known as Chain Home, registered incoming German planes using radio waves. But the system is imprecise. How many and exactly where these planes are is up to Johnson and his colleagues to determine by hunting around in the sky. It's a huge improvement over the method used during the last war, which relied on human observers stationed at lookouts. Chain Home has given England a fighting chance against the German assault, but there are limitations. Johnson swivels his head back and forth, but he can barely see anything in the pea soup of the clouds. He picks up his radio and calls ground control.
"There are no planes in sight. Over."
"You're in the right spot. Continue to visually scan. I've got to be there somewhere."
"Roger. I have limited visibility due to the cloud cover."
"We're rooting for you. Over."
Johnson circles back and keeps looking for those German planes. One of England's key airfields is below. If Germany destroys it, England will be in an even weaker position. On his right, Johnson spots a German bomber flying past him a mile away. He gets on his radio again.
"I see him."
He positions himself and fires his weapons. Johnson's shots miss, and the German plane continues on its way. Johnson takes off after him, but the German plane evades him in the cloud cover. The German plane dives down and drops its bombs. There's nothing Johnson can do. He picks up his radio again.
"Bloody hell! These detection systems are useless all the way down there. We need them in our planes up here. Then we might have a shot of actually tracking these Nazi bastards and shooting them down."
"From your lips to God's ears."
Scientists are not yet able to make radar systems that are powerful enough, yet small enough, to fit in planes. But across the Atlantic, the best of American physicists are working on this exact problem. The course of the war will depend on whether they can figure it out in time. From Wondery, I'm Stephen Johnson, and this is American Innovations. By the mid-1920s, scientists had discovered that radio waves bounce off objects in their path. Very quickly, they realized that they could use radar, short for radio detection and ranging, to detect enemy planes and ships. Early radar systems, however, were massive. Chain Home's towers were several hundred feet tall and weighed thousands of pounds. That's because early radar systems required large radio waves, and only large transmitters could generate them. The next few generations of radar systems were smaller, but nowhere near small enough to fit inside a plane. To accomplish that, scientists would need to make a radar system that generated and received much smaller waves, microwaves. This quest will involve an unprecedented international alliance, a secret mission, and a visionary millionaire. This is episode 1. Welcome to Tuxedo Park.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's 1935 in San Francisco, California, 5 years before the Battle of Britain. Across the Atlantic, England's chain home system is just being developed, and news of it hasn't reached America. It certainly hasn't reached Sigurd Varian, who's grown more and more distraught over Europe's chances against Germany. Now pacing his living room floor before his brother Russell, Sigurd obsesses over his latest preoccupation, his own country's failure to act. We're much more vulnerable than people think. Sigurd flops into a chair, his bushy eyebrows knit into an angry V. If the Germans really wanted to, they could invade Central America. And then how easy would it be for them to launch an attack on the United States? You can be sure that if I've thought of this, so has Hitler. You have a plan. I can tell. What do you have in mind? You know how I've been thinking about using radio waves for a navigation system for planes? Russell nods. Sigurd is a pilot with Pan Am, flying their Mexico and Central American routes. He's long complained that the maps of Mexico are inaccurate, and often tell him he's flying over a swamp when in fact he's flying over a mountain. It makes flying extremely dangerous whenever visibility is impaired.
Well, what if we could design a system that uses radio waves not just for navigation, but to detect other planes? Then it wouldn't matter if it was dark or overcast. We could see Hitler's fancy air force coming and give ourselves a fighting chance.
Russell leans forward. He's intrigued. Less by the idea of stopping Hitler, and more by the idea of solving a brand new technical challenge. Russell is dyslexic and struggles with math, but he earned his master's degree in physics at Stanford by coming up with inventive solutions to problems that no one else could crack.
You want to fit these systems on the planes. How big is the nose of a plane? It's about 30 inches.
Russell thinks about it.
That's tough. Why? Powerful radio waves are big, and a big wavelength can't physically fit through a small antenna. It would be like trying to carry a couch through a mouse hole. So if you want an antenna to fit inside the nose of a plane, we need to generate small waves. I'm thinking wavelengths around 4 inches, microwaves. So can we do this? If you handled the theory, and I handled the design and the building.
Since dropping out of college, Sigurd has given himself an advanced education in both mechanics and engineering. But Russell doesn't look convinced.
It's going to be tough. I mean, we have to send the waves out with enough power that the echo, which will be much weaker, makes it all the way back. The waves need enough juice to complete a round trip. But no one's been able to generate microwaves at more than 1 or 2 watts.
Sigurd gives his brother a sly look.
Just because no one's done it before doesn't mean we can't. Come on, let's do it. Let's make something the world hasn't seen before. This is what we dreamed of as kids.
Russell studies his brother's face. He's already got a steady job, but he's always found his brother hard to resist. Everything with him is an adventure.
All right, let's do it.
Sigurd lets out a whoop and wraps his big brother in a hug. The brothers moved back into their parents' house in Halcyon, California, and got to work. At the time, electromagnetic waves were primarily generated using a vacuum tube, a sealed glass tube with electrodes, or electric conductors, on either end. The electrodes drew and repelled electrons inside the tube, causing them to bounce back and forth rapidly, generating electromagnetic waves. But in order to generate smaller wavelengths, the tubes themselves had to be built smaller. The smaller the tubes, though, the less powerful the wave. For the purposes of creating powerful microwaves, it was a catch-22. Within a couple of months, it was clear to Russell that the traditional vacuum tube was a dead end. He had to figure out another way to generate the waves. He was stymied for over a year until, one day, a letter arrived in the mail. And after reading it, Russell knew exactly what to do. It is March 1937, and William Webster Hansen is working on some calculations in his small but sun-drenched office on the Stanford campus.
Come in. Russ, what are you doing here?
Hansen breaks out into a wide smile.
Come in.
Hansen and Russell were first-year roommates at Stanford when they became unlikely friends. Hansen was a prodigy who could do complex calculus in his head. He started his undergraduate career at 16 and had his PhD by 23. Russell, meanwhile, took 6 years to finish his BA. Undiagnosed learning disabilities put a PhD of his own out of reach. But the two have always gotten along. Hansen appreciates the intuitive leaps Russell is capable of making, and Russell appreciates Hansen's machine-like precision and the fact that Hansen never talks down to him.
So, old friend, this is unexpected. What brought you calling?
Russell pulls out the letter Hansen wrote and slaps it on his desk.
Your letter? Is what you wrote in it true? Have you really created a resonator that generates microwaves?
Hansen nods and points to a copper ball that sits on his desk. With indentations on the top and bottom, it looks like an apple.
This is it? We're calling it a rumbatron because of the way the waves dance inside it. It's like they're doing the rumba.
He picks it up and hands it to Russell, who examines it. The sphere is hollow, so it doesn't weigh much. Hansen points to the top indentation, which is an opening.
We hook the cathode up there and shoot electrons into the cavity, and the electrons bounce back and forth inside it, creating a wave. The dimensions of the sphere correspond with the frequency of the wave. So that one right there was built to produce microwaves. That's incredible. What are you going to do with it?
Hansen eyes his old friend.
I have the sense that you're about to tell me.
By the conversation's end, Hansen was officially on the team. He even proposed that the brothers move to Palo Alto so they could use Stanford's labs. As the brothers left Halcyon, Sigurd predicted they'd be back within 3 months. Sigurd was overly optimistic. To use the microwaves generated by the rumbatron in a radar system, Russell had to figure out how to turn the standing wave the rumbatron generated into a traveling wave that could be channeled through an antenna and out into space. Over the next year and a half, Russell came up with one idea after another, but most of them were too complicated to build or didn't check out when Hansen reviewed the math. But finally, Russell had a breakthrough. He combined Hansen's resonators with a vacuum tube and came up with what he, his brother, and Hansen would call a klystron. It could generate microwaves with up to 20 watts of power, a tenfold increase over what could previously be created. But it still wasn't enough power to make the radar system they wanted. While Sigurd and Russell turned their attention to manufacturing the klystron, Hansen stayed focused on using the klystron in a radar system. And Hansen wasn't alone. Several other Americans were working away on their own solutions to the same problem. And an amateur scientist, who also happened to be a millionaire, was about to bring them all together.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend, Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired-looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/wondery for your free trial.
It's 1939 in Tuxedo Park, New York. An investment banker, Alfred Loomis, sits in his living room, shuffling a deck of cards. His mind is elsewhere. He's just read about Hitler's invasion of Czechoslovakia. There's no denying that Hitler's ambitions are massive and that soon all of Europe will be dragged into war. Like Sigurd Varian, Loomis has felt that America is sticking its head in the sand by trying to remain out of the war. Across from him, his wife Ellen watches as he fans out a set of cards.
It's terrible what Hitler is doing over there, and yet so utterly predictable.
He offers her the cards.
Pick a card, any card.
Ellen pulls out a card and looks at it. Queen of Diamonds.
It is absolutely awful. First Austria, now Czechoslovakia. Hitler's never going to stop. You're absolutely correct. Now, have you memorized which card you have?
Ellen nods.
All right, put it back. It's worse than the newspapers are saying. The weapons Germany has, both the field artillery and the bombs, are devastating. These tanks are new, too. Our military is not ready at all. It's shameful. We could be, if not for the ridiculous bureaucracy of the United States Army.
When the United States entered the First World War, Loomis was 29. He immediately enlisted. Since he had majored in math at Yale, he was sent to Aberdeen, Maryland, where the Army tested weaponry. At Aberdeen, Loomis developed artillery alongside scientific luminaries, such as Thomas Edison. He's proud of the work they did, but he also became disillusioned with the Army's bureaucracy during his time there. In particular, how slow the Army was to embrace any new technology. Now Loomis has no faith that the Army will be able to develop weapons fast enough to counter Germany when the U.S. gets drawn into the war, as he adamantly believes it will.
You know what Thomas Edison proposed at the start of the last war? About the lab?
Loomis ignores her question and barrels forward, putting the deck of cards aside.
He suggested that the U.S. government fund a lab that did nothing but develop weapons. That way, when the war did break out, we would be ready. The military would know exactly which weapons to manufacture and could do so quickly. Of course, the government did no such thing, and now we're going to be caught flat-footed.
His wife watches him, one eyebrow arched.
You have a lab? Yes, but not... Well, I suppose that's true, I do. Perhaps I should be the one taking Edison's advice.
His wife smiles to herself.
Mm-hmm.
In the years after Loomis made his fortune by investing in electric companies, he turned his full attention to science. And Loomis isn't just a hobbyist. He's co-authored dozens of papers that have been published in leading journals. In 1926, he even bought a three-story mansion in Tuxedo Park, a town about an hour north of New York City, and converted the mansion into a laboratory. Now Loomis's mind races with new possibilities. What if his own lab could be used to develop war technology? He'd need to choose which technology to focus on, choose a problem where he wouldn't get bogged down in theory, where he could make a significant impact in a short amount of time. He'll have to start making calls immediately. As he passes his wife, he pauses and plucks one card from the deck.
By the way, this was your card.
Ellen takes it and laughs. The Queen of Diamonds. A student of magic since he was a child, Loomis loves to perform tricks. And they always work. Soon after, Loomis receives a phone call from his friend Carl Compton, president of MIT.
Alfred Loomis speaking.
Alfred, how are you doing?
Good, good, good. Yourself?
Can't complain. Look, a little bird told me you're looking for a project to take on. I might be able to pique your curiosity about something.
Go on, I'm listening.
Well, at MIT, we've started working on using microwave technology as a detection device. It's speculative right now, but it has huge potential. It would allow detection systems to be small enough to be installed on planes, and it would provide better accuracy than anything we're seeing with radio waves. It would be a big advantage for our boys in the military if we had this.
Oh, that sounds intriguing. Let me look into it.
Loomis knows a little about waves due to research he's done into brain waves. More importantly, he trusts his friend when he says this would help the war effort. Loomis immediately goes about learning everything he can about microwave generation and radio wave detection systems. He's always been quick to grasp scientific concepts, and even better at spotting which ideas have big potential. Now, Loomis has microwave radar in his crosshairs. It has everything he's looking for in a project. Even though generating microwaves at the power necessary hasn't been accomplished yet, it feels solvable. Loomis can imagine putting a team together at his lab, funding their research, and coming out with a workable system in a short matter of time, at which point he can turn the project over to the military for full implementation. Sometime later, Loomis calls Compton back.
Carl, it's Alfred. I'm in. I'll fund the initial research and open up my lab at Tuxedo Park to your MIT researchers. Who else is making headway with this?
Loomis wastes little time in rounding up his team. His first stop after MIT is Palo Alto. It's April 1940, and Loomis has just returned from his trip out west. He bought 10 Klystrons from the Varian brothers, who are beginning to ramp up production. And he's convinced Bill Hansen to come back to Tuxedo Park with him. Now he's introducing him to the rest of the team.
Dr. Hansen, welcome to Loomis Laboratories.
Hansen looks around in awe. This isn't a lab. It's a palace of science. He turns to Loomis, impressed.
Oh, this lab is all state-of-the-art. More advanced than Stanford's lab.
Loomis grins.
I think you'll find it better equipped than any university's lab in the country.
They're standing in the converted basement of the three-floor mansion called Tower House. Loomis gestures towards the stairs.
The entire house is for our scientists. First floor is office space, the second floor is living space. We even have a theater. I'll show you all that later. But first, let me introduce you to the boys.
Hansen looks around the lab, where roughly a dozen researchers are hunched over their workbenches. Many of them are academics like Hansen, here for the summer before school starts up again, while others are from industrial labs that want to commercially produce the radar systems once they're developed. Hansen knows that Loomis is covering his salary, and he presumes Loomis is covering everyone else's too.
Gentlemen, this is W.W. Hansen. He's here with us from Stanford. I'm sure you've heard of his Rumbotron.
He's also one of the inventors of the Klystron.
Brilliant new device, I believe is a game changer for microwave detection systems. I was the first customer to buy some, and we'll be experimenting with them shortly.
Hansen waves.
Nice to meet you all. I look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Let's talk brass tacks for a moment.
Hansen finds a seat, and Loomis paces. The other scientists put down their work to listen.
Look, we know we need to find a way to coax more power out of the Klystron. But that's not all we have to do. I want to know that this idea works. The idea that microwaves are capable of more sensitive detection is purely speculative. Our primary goal is to prove to the military that this technology is worth investing in.
At this point, both the Army and the Navy have radar systems similar to England's Chain Home. They use large waves and employ huge antennas weighing thousands of pounds. But just like Chain Home, they are not sensitive enough to detect single planes or determine how many planes are coming in a formation. Loomis paces as he thinks out loud.
I want to build a system that can pick out a single plane, even if it can't do so at the distance we ultimately need it to. And I want that system to be able to determine how fast an object is moving. These are tangible benefits to a microwave radar system. Let's prove that this is more than just science fiction.
Hansen nods.
So you want us to start building a model detection system, even though we know we don't have the power for it to be fully effective?
Loomis points at him.
Exactly.
The academics exchange covert looks.
Their inclination is to focus on theory first, but Loomis is the boss. Loomis turns back around to Hansen.
The war is happening now. If we're going to be of any aid in this effort, we need to sell the military on this technology now.
Loomis believes in hands-on experimentation over theory. He argues that one collects more data building a system than putzing around with equations. But there's another reason he's jumping in headfirst. Even as the 10th wealthiest man in the country, Loomis can't afford to fund the project forever. His ultimate goal is to have the U.S. government take over. And for that to happen, he needs to prove microwave radar's functionality before the project bankrupts him. The researchers get to work, going down to the lab 7 days a week, building transmitting and receiving antennas, as well as a display monitor. In a couple of months, they're ready to test it out. The team drags the apparatus upstairs from the basement lab, pointing the transmitter out the third-story window. Outside, a researcher holds a bunch of balloons. Inside, Hansen and the others cram around their device. It's on and waiting. Hansen leans out the window.
All right, let it go.
Down below, the scientist lets a balloon go. The scientists stare at the display. The balloon sails past the window. The screen stays black. There's no dot indicating the balloon.
Is it on? Of course it's on.
Hansen leans out the window again and shouts down.
Try another one.
The scientist below lets go of another balloon. It sails up by the window. Nothing. They try more with the same results. Nothing. The team is discouraged. They're a long way off from a working system. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic Ocean, France has just surrendered to Germany. Britain will be Germany's next target. The fate of the world rests on the British defending themselves. But Germany's air force is seemingly all-powerful, and the key to defeating it is a microwave radar system that can't yet detect a balloon, let alone a plane.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
It's June 1940, and Loomis drives up to the Loomis Laboratory building in an old delivery truck he's just bought. He honks the horn, and the scientists come out to see his spoils. It's old, the paint is chipping off the side, and it clearly states that it was once used to deliver diapers. The scientists raise their eyebrows.
Don't worry about her looks, boys. We'll get her painted. I'm thinking green with gold trim and Loomis Laboratories across the side. What do you think?
Hansen grimaces.
We'll always know it was a Diddy wagon. And that's what she will be called if you insist. But I want the new device installed in here as soon as possible. And then we'll need to take her for a test drive.
In the month since the balloon test, Loomis's team has been finessing its device. They realized that a smaller wavelength also meant their antenna produced a narrower beam. When the wavelength was longer and the beam was consequently wider, it was easier for the receiver to pick up its target. Loomis's team fixed the problem by programming the antenna to scan side to side so it covered a wider area. Since then, their radar system has been able to identify not only balloons, but a boat on a lake. Now Loomis wants to test it on cars. In particular, he wants to test the accuracy of their system's speed detection. Cars, with their built-in speedometers, are the perfect subject for the experiment. The scientists work hard to install their detection system in the truck. It's not pretty. The transmitting and receiving antennas are approximately 3 feet long and just under a foot wide. Mounted on a rotating platform, they stick out the back of the truck by close to a yard. A few days later in June, the team takes the truck to the local golf course and parks it with the antenna facing the highway. Loomis's 21-year-old son, Henry, has followed them in his own car. Loomis gets out of the Diddy truck and walks to Henry's car.
All right, head out onto the highway and go 40 miles per hour exactly. Got it.
few minutes later, the scientists spot Henry's car headed down the highway. They crowd around the screen. A dot lights up on the indicator screen, and the readout displays the number 40. It is clocking him going 40 miles per hour. The men are ecstatic. After months of work, they have a microwave radar system that is detecting an object's velocity. They keep their radar aimed at the highway and track the speeds of passing cars. One after another, they come in. 45 miles per hour, 53 miles per hour, 48 miles per hour.
We better not let the cops get a hold of this. No one is going the speed limit.
June 1940. Congress is still determined to keep the U.S. out of the war, but Roosevelt has just established the National Defense Research Committee. It's the first collaboration between civilian and military scientists in the United States history, and its goal will be to identify technology with potential military use and spearhead research into those fields. Loomis is now heading down a long hallway in a government building on his way to a meeting with his old friend Carl Compton and Vannevar Bush, who has been tapped by President Roosevelt to run the NDRC. Being summoned here is a good sign. Loomis quickens his stride. Loomis steps into Bush's office, where Compton is sitting in a plush leather chair. Both men greet Loomis warmly.
Alfred, welcome. So glad you could make it.
Good to see you, Alfred.
Loomis shakes their hands and takes a seat.
How are things going in Tuxedo Park?
Loomis catches them up on their experiments tracking cars.
Our next goal is to track an individual plane. Obviously, power is still an issue. We're not generating more than the initial 20 watts of power that the Klystron is capable of. But we've learned a lot about these systems, and the potential they show is great.
Bush cuts to the chase.
Here's why we called you here. Within the NDRC, we've created a division devoted to detection. We've put Compton here in charge of that division. Oh, congratulations, Carl. I couldn't think of anyone better.
Compton turns to Loomis.
And I want you in charge of the microwave subsection. I pointed you in the direction of microwaves just about a year ago, and look how far you've come since then. I don't think there's anyone better who could coordinate between civilian scientists and military ones. Of course, I'd be honored. But coordination is vital. The NDRC's mandate is to find out what research the Army and the Navy want done and to facilitate that. Now, obviously, we think that a microwave radar detection system is of the utmost priority, but we've heard there's some skepticism about that within the military. Your first job will be to show them that this is worth the time and resources.
Of course.
Loomis's intention has always been for the government to take over the research, and he knows the Army has to see the potential of his research for that to happen. Bush leans forward and puts his hand on Loomis's shoulder.
If the military doesn't come on board with a microwave radar detection set, then we'll need to focus our attention where they want it and put that project on hold.
Loomis nods. He's not overly concerned. Once the military sees what they've done in Tuxedo Park, he's confident they will embrace this new technology. In the months that followed, Loomis began to arrange meetings with representatives from both the Army and the Navy. But right away, he ran into difficulty. Neither branch of the military was enthusiastic about working with civilian scientists who had been foisted upon them by the president. They especially resented working with Loomis, who had little in the way of formal scientific training. They regarded him as an interloper. The Navy, the crown jewel of the American military, was particularly dismissive of Loomis and his ideas. They were proud of their radar system and didn't see the need for any outsider help. Loomis had a little better luck with the Army. In August, representatives from the Army came out to Tuxedo Park to see what Loomis's team had developed. It's a hot, humid August day in 1940. Loomis, Hansen, and representatives from the Army are crammed into the Diddy wagon. Sweat is pasting their shirts to their bodies, and everyone is irritable. They are parked at Bendix Airfield, not far from Tuxedo Park. Loomis leans out of the truck and waves his arm at his son, Henry, who is sitting in a small plane on the tarmac.
Take her away, son.
The plane takes off, and Loomis powers on the radar system. Henry pilots the plane in circles above them. Loomis and the others hover over the screen. It's not the first time they've tested the radar with planes, but with the Army literally looking over their shoulder, there's more pressure. A dot appears on the screen. The radar has picked up the plane.
Loomis and the scientists breathe a sigh of relief. Loomis points at the dot on the screen, as if the Army representative could miss it.
Look at that. It's picking up a single plane. Your radar systems can't do that.
The representative nods.
That is impressive, I'll grant you that. But what's its range? How far can you follow that plane for?
Loomis and Hansen exchange a look. Hansen clears his throat.
Right now the range is 2 miles.
The Army men smirk.
2 miles? We have a 22-mile range on our system.
Loomis speaks up.
We know power is an issue, but once we solve that problem...
The Army representative cuts him off.
But when will the power issue be solved? Our research says that it's years away. And I know what you think, Loomis, that we at the Army are fuddy-duddies, that we lack vision. But it's not just us. We have word that RCA and GE are about to shut down their microwave programs because they see no commercial viability in it. That's the very definition of a lack of vision. You're abandoning a fantastic piece of technology without even trying to solve the problem. But you're barking up the wrong tree. And the point of this collaboration is for you to facilitate research on technology that we want, that we can use now on the war that is breathing down our neck, not on the next war. This is a waste of time and money, Loomis.
The Army representatives exit the truck and get back in their car. Loomis and Hansen watch them go. There's nothing left to say. The academics Loomis brought to Tuxedo Park will be heading back to their schools as soon as the new semester begins. And with the Army telling him to focus his efforts elsewhere, the window to develop a microwave radar system that will impact the upcoming war is slipping away. But the breakthrough Loomis is waiting for is being designed across the ocean in a war-ravaged England. And it will take an unprecedented act of diplomacy to bring it to America.
From Wondery, this is episode 1 of Radar for American Innovations. If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and a review, and be sure to tell your friends. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. Please support them. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a small survey at wondery.com/survey and tell us which innovation stories you'd like to hear. And a quick note about the recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they're based on historical research. American Innovations is hosted by me, Stephen Johnson. For more information on my books about science and innovation, including my latest, Enemy of All Mankind, you can visit my website, stephenberlinjohnson.com. Sound design on this episode is by Landon Lipinski. This episode was written by Austin Rackless, with additional research by Anne Sharnhurst, with editing by Liza Veal. Produced by Natalie Shisha, executive produced by Jenny Lauer Beckman, Marshall Louis, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.